Welcome to In Context War Report. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. With me is In Context military affairs commentator, Marchand McDermott Rowe.
Hello, everyone.
While the United States enjoyed the status as the world's sole military superpower for several years after the collapse of the Soviet Union, it now confronts new challenges from various quarters. Its principal rivals for global hegemony today are China, a newcomer to the international stage, and Russia, which has emerged with considerable strength from the ashes of the Soviet Union. In today's program, we're going to focus on Russia. What are the essential characteristics of the Russians? What are Russia's political objectives? And how formidable is Russia's military challenge to the United States? In order to answer these questions, we're going to take a close look at some of the important events in Russian history, including wars, events that shaped the nation and its people. But Marchand, I'd like to start out with a general question about the Russians. Are Russians a warrior race?
Well, I think most definitely. You're talking about a people who, from their inception, have been faced with not only a harsh environment, but surrounded by enemies. They've been fighting their neighbors since ancient times, and they're descendants of the Vikings. So I think it's very safe to say that they are a warrior people. I mean, you could see that in their spirit today, the fact that they hold military parades of enormous magnitude. And for example, the United States holds a Macy's Day parade.
I see. Well, that's an interesting comparison. And you alluded to the early history of Russia. And I'd like to go back to some important events that occurred even before the existence of the modern Russian nation state. The precursor of Russia was the state of Kiev. And it was founded in the 9th century by Rus people who, as you mentioned, their origins lay in Viking Scandinavia. The state of Kiev became in the Middle Ages one of the largest and most prosperous states in Europe. Its main cities were Kiev and Novgorod, and its territory included much of what later became the Russian nation. However, this prosperous entity, the state of Kiev, in 1237, experienced a tremendous catastrophe which left an indelible mark on its people. Can you talk about this catastrophe that occurred in 1237?
Absolutely. This catastrophe was probably the equivalent of having an atomic bomb hit you, as I heard one historian describe it when referring to the Mongols sweeping through Afghanistan. When the Mongols swept into Russia in 1237, they decimated the Russian countryside, and they burned Kiev. And the Mongols didn't wage just war of attrition. They didn't just wage war for plunder. They waged war for absolute destruction. It was often terror simply for the sake of terror. They figured if we frighten our enemies enough, we're more horrible than anything they can ever imagine. They will never resist. And what it ultimately led to was Kiev, the capital of the people of the Rus, which is where we get the word Russia from, the land of the Rus. After Kiev was burned, the Russian noblemen were subjugated. And they were actually forced to not only pay homage and pay, well, in essence, protection money to the Mongols, but every year Russian princes were forced to pay homage by feeding the horses of their Mongol overlords.
So in addition to slaughtering half the people, the Mongols absolutely humiliated the elite.
I think unless you were a nation that was attacked by the Mongols, very few civilizations ever really had to experience this kind of humiliation because, it's different from the Huns sweeping through Western Europe. When the Huns sacked Western Europe, they did just that. They sacked Western Europe, and they were then defeated by the Romans. But this was absolute humiliation.
And it's fair to say that the United States has never experienced anything akin to this.
Oh, no, not at all. And like I say, it's something that shows very deeply in the personalities of the people and in their attitude towards war.
What do you think it says about their attitudes towards security, towards personal safety versus other values such as personal freedom?
Well, in the case of the Russians, absolutely. This left an indelible stain on the Russian personality. Not only the shame of being humiliated, but the fear. You know, we have a collective conscience as a society. And as a society, we have a collective memory. And so the Russians, as a people, remember the Mongols sweeping through. They remember the destruction. They remember the humiliation they went. And after their liberation, they swore never to be subjugated like that again. So their central focus became security and practical security. I mean, Russia before sending troops overseas, built a missile defense shield to protect them from anything and everything. On the other hand, the United States, we have TSA officers that are supposed to protect us from, I don't know, Russian bombers and the Chinese, I suppose, but we send our armies out overseas. So clearly for us as a society, we're not really concerned with security. And you can see this also in other Western societies, even. In Britain, domestic security plays a greater role than personal freedom because they remember the Blitz. In Russia, domestic security is more important than personal freedom because they remember the Mongols. In Germany, domestic security is more important than personal freedom because they remember the Russians.
I guess it all could also explain, as we've talked about in other shows on the War Report, is the fact that the United States doesn't have much in the way of coastal defenses. It's like we're not really worried about being invaded.
No, not at all. And that's because for the longest time, really for most of our history, the only real invasion we ever suffered was, because I don't count the Mexican-American War because that was kind of the most lopsided conflict in American history. But really, the only legitimate invasion we ever faced was the War of 1812. And after that, the sense was we have seas on either side of us, especially after the conquest of the West. We have oceans on either side. There is no reason why we should be frightened of an invader. Who's going to be able to cross these massive oceans? When you think about it, it's a very medieval concept. It's the same reason why the Aztecs, you know, felt that nobody would ever invade them, because who would cross these massive oceans but gods? And now we still have that same mentality. The only difference is, just like the Spaniards had developed ships capable of crossing the oceans that the Aztecs could never imagine, the Russians and the Chinese have been investing in long-range submarines and bombers that can fly across the ocean. Our mentality is that of a people who've never faced an invasion.
Well, the Russians managed to endure and to survive the Mongol occupation. And in the 1400s, the Duchy of Moscow really becomes the successor of the state of Kiev. The Moscovites throw out the Mongols, and they incorporate some of their rivals within what's now Russia into the Duchy of Moscow, including the city of Novgorod, which was very important in ancient times. But then in 1453, there's a very important event that occurs outside Russia, which has a very important significance as far as the evolution of the Russian personality. And that is the fall of Constantinople to the Muslim Turks. Now, Constantinople had been for 1,000 years the capital of the Byzantine Empire. And the Byzantine Empire was the eastern half of the Roman Empire. It continued long after the western half collapsed for 1,000 years. And Russia had obtained its religion, Orthodox Christianity, from the Byzantine Empire, as well as its alphabet. So what was the psychological effect, and what was the effect on the Russian identity of the capture of Constantinople by the Muslim Turks?
Well, I think there were two seminal events in Russian history, I mean, that really define who the Russians are today. Well, I mean, there are a lot of them, but two especially, and one is the fall of Constantinople, the other is the formation and the fall of the Soviet Union. This is where we see the word Tsar come from. The Tsar means Caesar, kind of like in German, Kaiser means Caesar, not king. People often mistake it for
that. A title which the leader of the Russian people adopted after the fall of Constantinople.
The idea was he was the inheritor of the Eastern Roman Empire, Eastern Christendom, but more importantly, the Eastern Roman Empire. But what's interesting, though, is the Russians as a people, during the times of the Tsars, even I suppose afterwards, they were not a theocratic society, though. It was not a theocratic society in so much as, let's say, the Western Roman Empire was. You know, Latin Christendom, you know, either you are a Latin or we killed you almost. I mean, the first people killed by the Crusaders were the Jews. Whereas I think the Russians took on much more of the cosmopolitan Eastern Roman Empire philosophy. So theirs wasn't as much a theocratic empire as it was going to be a Roman Empire. They dreamed one day of an empire that would be as great as Rome, as glorious as Rome, encompassing large quantities of people, which is why their empire was so successful.
And in fact, Ivan III married the niece of the last Byzantine emperor, Constantine XI, and he even adopted the Byzantine double eagle as his coat of arms.
Absolutely, and that's still the Russian coat of arms today.
And then it was the next century that Ivan the Terrible was the first one to say, hey, I'm Caesar, and called himself the Tsar.
Exactly.
Now, also, the Russians don't really have an ethnic concept of empire, do they?
Their concept of empire, again, is much more Roman. What we see in the modern age, well, actually, really, not just the 20th century, but throughout Western history, is two concepts of empire: the racial concept of empire and the Roman concept of empire. And now if you want to look at, example, the racial concept of empire, you look at the Japanese. When they conquered, it was you were Japanese or you were less than human. Then you look at the Roman concept of empire and you see the British Empire. You see, well, even the French. You see, and this was the model for the Russians, the idea of we are a multi-ethnic empire. Our empire is based not on race or religion, but based on the on a principle, on an idea. In the case of Rome, it was the idea of the republic, the idea of the empire. In Russia, to be Russian takes on a much broader sense than it does. You know, when we think of Russians, we tend to think blonde-haired, blue-eyed, square-faced.
And this is
the
Scandinavian background.
The Scandinavian backgrounds. But in reality, I've met Russians personally who are round-faced with Asian eyes. I mean, they are Chinese. They are of Chinese descent. But they have names like, you know, Mikhail Vladimirovich, you know, and things like that. They're completely Russian because what it means to be Russian is different than, let's say, what we in the West tend to think. We in the West tend to put a much more racial context on it.
Right. And because Russian is a great culture, they're probably proud to be part of that, to speak the Russian language and be associated with that culture.
And one thing Russia is doing today, which they did in particularly the days of Peter the Great, Russia goes through these phases of isolationism and then expansion. But when they go into their expansion phases, we look at like the days of Peter the Great, they start incorporating people from other cultures. And like nowadays, what we're seeing, there's that famous French actor who emigrated to Russia. Now, 10 years ago, emigration to Russia was unheard of, not just because.
I think you're calling back to Gérard Depardieu.
Gérard Depardieu. 10 years ago, it would have been impossible, not really because of the cultural restrictions, because of the legal restrictions. I mean, who would have wanted to live in Russia 10 years ago anyway? But the point is that now Russia's opening its borders. The caveat, the catch, if you will, from what I read on Russia Today, was that they expect you to speak Russian. They expect you to speak Russian, and they expect you to become Russian. The idea not being that we are, you know, the idea being that we don't expect you to be blonde-haired and blue-eyed. We don't expect you to be Russian Orthodox, but we expect you to speak Russian.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context War Report on listener-sponsored WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and we're streaming live at WPKN.org. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marchand McDermott Rowe about Russia as a rival to the United States for global power. In particular, we're examining important military and political events in Russian history, and we're trying to gain a better understanding of the Russian mentality, as well as Russia's global objectives and its military capabilities. And we'll consider what this all means for the United States. One of the interesting groups that got incorporated into the Russian Empire as it developed was the Cossacks, because they were really very independent people. But over time, they became Russified. Can you talk a little bit about the Cossacks?
Absolutely. The Cossacks are a warrior people from the steppes and of Eastern Europe, of the Caucasus. And they were a very rugged, very cultured people. They weren't necessarily nomadic, but they were a horse people from the steppe, and they were very fierce, very warlike. And actually, they were incorporated as part of the Tsar's Imperial Guard up until the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917. And now they're actually being incorporated again in the Russian police force by Vladimir Putin in their own element. I mean, nowadays, you can see police officers in Moscow dressed in Russian police uniforms in the style of the traditional Cossack guard, and with a sword and everything.
These Cossack communities were really semi-military organizations, and the communities were organized in what they called hosts. We don't have any concept of what this is like, but I guess they were like, they had their leader, and they were like regiments associated with your town or your community.
Oh, absolutely.
And I guess, as I understand it, they eventually stopped fighting the Russians and decided to become functionaries of the Russians, working for them to secure borders and serve in the army and throughout their really the 19th, 20th, and 21st century history.
Well, absolutely. And that's why they were given that special status, because they were such fierce warriors. They were the Tsar's most feared soldiers, were his Cossack Imperial Guard. And like I say, nowadays being reincorporated back into the new system of government is really, I think, something that's indicative of the last,
in fact,
you know, 400,
it was part
years
of
Russian history.
Modern Russian history is that the hosts, which had been suppressed after the revolution, are now back in existence. They've been recognized, and the Cossack hosts, the Cossack communities now experience this resurgence. And with that, I'm sure all the military strength that comes with that.
Absolutely. And that's why I said, like I said, Vladimir Putin's restored them to the status as police officers. And I've seen photographs of them, and they're there in their garb with swords. I mean, but they're intimidating. They're big guys. I mean, big dudes.
Well, now, you mentioned a moment ago Peter the Great, and he's really a towering figure in the development of modern Russia, the modern nation state of Russia. Can you talk about Peter the Great?
Peter the Great was...
And if I could just put it in people's context, he ruled in the late 1600s and early 1700s in Russia.
Peter the Great was he was the great reformer of Russia. He took Russia out of the Middle Ages. Prior to Peter the Great, Russia was seen as a backwards third world medieval country ruled by boyars or noblemen. And it had none of the medical or military advances of the rest of Western Europe. Because at this time, you saw the founding in the West of the new model army. You saw, the beginnings
of the
Enlightenment.
That was Oliver Cromwell in England?
Oliver Cromwell in England. The army starting to wear uniforms. You had really this leap forward militarily as well as technologically in terms of science, especially medicine, Holland becoming the center of medicine. So I think what you start to see after that is, in Russia, you're seeing that they're still in the Middle Ages. So Europe's moving forward, Russia's still in the Middle Ages. So Peter the Great became exposed to this. He became exposed to these technological advances. He started to read about the outside world. And so when he became czar, the first thing he did is modernize. He actually went with his doctors to places like Holland to learn medicine. He learned how to build ships in England. He had studied. He actually was in his own right a shipwright. He also again did something that only now Vladimir Putin's starting to do, which is bring in outside talent. The admiral that commanded Peter the Great's navy was in fact an Irishman. What you start to see with Peter the Great is you start to see the technological revolution, you start to see the social revolution, power taken away from the boyars, isolationism disappear, ethnocentrism start to disappear, and then the incorporation of outsiders, of Western Europeans, incorporation of Western European technology, and the emergence of Russia as a modern industrial power.
To what extent do the Russians see themselves as Westerners versus something else?
They're kind of in their own category. They're Slavs, and Slavs are really in their own category. They're not Far Easterners. They're not Western Europeans. They're Slavs, and they identify themselves. There is sort of a unified Slavic identity between the Russians and the Serbians, for example, and the Russo-centric people, the Orthodox people of the region, especially. But the people who share the same linguistic, the same writing system and similar culture, the Slavic peoples, all share that common identity, which is neither Western nor Eastern. It's a category of its own.
So he was a really hands-on guy. Did his programs, did they have a lasting effect?
Well, I mean, as much as anything has lasting effect in Russia, Russia, much like China, goes through these periods of enlightenment, empire building, and massive expansion, and then come crashing down and then back up, and much like most civilizations do. His effects did last through his, Catherine the Great, who was his granddaughter, unless I'm mistaken.
And she ruled Russia from 1762 to 1796. So we're talking really the period of the Enlightenment in Western Europe. And she continued the territorial expansion of Russia.
Absolutely. And she and Frederick the Great actually signed, Frederick the Great of Prussia, signed the world's first treaty against torture, believe it or not.
So she did absorb some of the concepts of the Enlightenment.
Oh, absolutely. She was very much a woman of the Enlightenment. And at the same time, so was Frederick the Great. So really what you see in this period is, again, a period of expansion, a period of enlightenment, and a period of growth in Russia.
And Catherine the Great was particularly interested in expansion to the south and towards Constantinople. And it seems that, I mean, she didn't get all the way there, but she did expand Russia to the Black Sea. And I think it goes with a concept of, well, they want warm water ports. They want access eventually to the Mediterranean. I think eventually they would like Constantinople, or now Istanbul, to be under their influence, perhaps part of their empire.
Well, I think at the time, because they were Russian Orthodox, they wanted to be the ones to retake Constantinople. But I think it ran deeper than that. I think a lot of that was more or less propaganda for the masses.
I see.
I think what they really wanted is they wanted those warm water ports. They wanted, I mean, Peter the Great had fought against the Ottomans. What they wanted was they wanted to sever really Western Europe's ties with the East. Because if they would now dominate the Silk Road, and they would also, having the warm water ports, dominate, be able to have their navy dominate the Mediterranean, which would now allow them to compete with the other Western powers. Because at this time, really, in the age of Catherine the Great, Britain is emerging as the world's foremost naval superpower, which is kind of making the Silk Road redundant.
Yes.
So just simply dominating Constantinople, or simply moving south and invading into Syria and whatnot, would not do it. You had to have the warm water ports because you had to challenge the Royal Navy. And that's really where this, where we start to see the rivalry between Britain and Russia, Russia and the West.
And another theme that's really important in the 18th and 19th, right at the beginning, right to the early part of the 20th century, is the decline of the Ottoman Empire, which expanded in the 1400s, really with its zenith around 1500, controlled large parts of the Mideast, North Africa, Eastern Europe. For a long time, Greece was under the Ottoman Empire, and it was the most one of the most formidable powers of its time. But then it went into a long period of decline. It fell behind technologically in the 1700s and 1800s. And it seemed like all the Westerners were licking their chops as to who would get a piece of the Ottoman Empire once it finally collapsed. And that brings us to a very important war in Russian history, the Crimean War, which took place between 1853 and 1856. Can you talk about the Crimean War?
Absolutely. Well, the Crimean War was, the Crimean War was really a war fought for control of the Black Sea, or the Caspian Sea. I'm sorry, my geography is getting a little messed up.
The Black Sea.
The Black Sea. Why was I thinking Caspian Sea?
It's that little peninsula.
Yeah, it's a little peninsula that juts out into
the Black Sea.
And the importance of it is Sevastopol is the headquarters of the Russian Navy. Now, if the Russian Navy could defeat the Ottomans, you see, the fleet nominally is bottled up in the Black Sea. Unless they can defeat the Ottoman Navy, destroy the Ottoman forts along the Dardanelles, and now have a direct route from the Black Sea into the Mediterranean. And so for the Russians, the war was crucial because they did want to defeat the Ottoman fleets and the Ottoman armed forces so they could have that access to the Mediterranean. Meanwhile, the Ottomans obviously didn't want this, but
who are the friends of the Ottomans?
The Brits and the French.
Yes.
Because the British and the French, neither of whom wanted the Russians to dominate the Mediterranean. Because one thing a lot of people forget is the Russians militarily, by this point in history, were no joke. Their military was strong. Their soldiers had a great fighting esprit, and they were technologically speaking equal with the Europeans. The only thing that would defeat the Russians ultimately during the Tsarist period was Russian military leadership at the time, because it was based largely off of, and you see this during the Crimean War, largely off nobles who had no experience militarily. I mean, you saw the same thing during the Napoleonic Wars with the British Army. Nobles who had bought their commissions or were awarded their commissions by the Tsar, who had no military qualifications, and therefore would make really bumbling military decisions. And the Crimean War, coincidentally, was, I believe, the last war where British officers could buy their commissions.
And, of course, this is the famous charge of the Light Brigade occurs during the Crimean War, which is a tremendous slaughter, although did not indicate how the whole war was going to go, but it was a horrible disaster.
It was the most visible, largely because this was the first war where you had war correspondents. Again, people tend to think war correspondents began with the American Civil War, but it didn't. War correspondents began in the Crimea. And so the Charge of the Light Brigade is so iconic because there were correspondents there to write about it.
How does the Crimean War get resolved? Who are the winners and losers, and what's the fallout for Russia?
It was one of those wars where they fought more or less to a bloodied stalemate. No one side really gained clear victory. Ultimately, the British and the Ottomans and the French withdrew from the Crimea. The Russians still held their fleet in the Black Sea, but they were so drained financially and militarily from the Crimean War because they threw a lot of men into it that it really did. It stumped the Russian efforts, you know, to advance any further south. They'd become so drained militarily that there was not much of a threat of them attacking the Dardanelles anytime soon.
So as I understand it, then the Russian Empire kind of holds its own during the rest of the 19th century. The Ottoman Empire is propped up really by British foreign policy until the eve of the World War I, because the British decide just as well to keep the weak Ottoman Empire intact as a buffer against Russia as let it collapse. And it's only just before World War I where they abandoned that policy, and they and the British decided, hey, the French and the British, we can take the Ottoman Empire and divvy it up for themselves. Before World War I, Russia has another important war, which ends up having a long-term effect on its on the country politically as well, and that's the Russo-Japanese War, which takes place 1904-1905. Can you talk about what that war was about and how Russia fared?
Absolutely. And again, history repeats itself. You could probably compare the disaster of the Russo-Japanese War to the Russian first invasion in the first Chechen War when Yeltsin's army invaded Chechnya. You had a very poorly equipped Russian army, a very poorly led Russian army, I mean, going up against the finest of the Japanese Imperial Army. And at this time, Russia was still considered a superpower, but what was destroying Russia from within militarily was nepotism, and it was lack of funding. Bribery and whatnot had started to become rampant, so soldiers weren't getting what they needed. People were embezzling the Tsar's money, and militarily, Russia was in the position it would be later on in the 90s.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context War Report on listener-sponsored WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and we're streaming live at WPKN.org. I'm your host, Ken McDermott-Rowe, and I'm speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marchand McDermott-Rowe about Russia as a rival to the United States for global power. In particular, we're examining important military and political events in Russian history, and we're trying to gain a better understanding of the Russian mentality, as well as Russia's global objectives and its military capabilities. And we'll consider what this all means for the United States. Corruption, does that seem to be a continual problem with Russia?
It's a continual problem worldwide. I guess in living in the West, our media exposes the corruption that goes on in Russia a lot more clearly. But as you can tell, there are periods where there is a tremendous amount of corruption, periods where there's no corruption. And one could argue that the same corruption goes on in the U.S. just at a much higher level. Russians were fighting the Japanese with bolt-action rifles that were used in the 1880s. You know, that by 1905 was out of date, and Americans are being equipped with a weapon that fundamentally hasn't changed since Vietnam. There are parallels. The only difference, though, is that in Russia, the graft was coming from the noblemen. In America, the graft's coming from the armaments manufacturers and the congressmen and senators.
So why does Russia go to war with Japan?
Well, Japan was the emerging empire in the Far East at this time. You had the Meiji Restoration, the opening of Japan, the modernization of Japan, and Japan decided it didn't want to end up like China and get carved up. So militarily, it really bulked up to compete with the West. And the real test of this was the Russo-Japanese War, when the Japanese ambushed the Russian fleet at Port Arthur and invaded Manchuria.
The modernization, for those who saw the movie The Last Samurai with Tom Cruise, depicts that Meiji Restoration and the tremendous desire of the Japanese to modernize their military because, as I recall, the Tom Cruise character is brought over from America to help train the new modern Japanese army.
They brought over American military contractors. They brought over British. They brought over French and Russian and German. Their goal was just to be able to compete with the West. That really, they did not want to end up carved up to pieces like China. And then eventually when they realized they could match the West, they said, well, why don't we take the West on? So they attacked the Russian fleet at Port Arthur, smashed the Russian military on land in Manchuria, and conquered part of northeastern China.
And the Russians wanted, as I understand it, a warm water port, a year-round port in the Pacific, and that's why Port Arthur was important.
And Port Arthur was obtained by the Russians early on. You would say the late 19th century. I was going to say early 20th century, but no, it was really the late 19th century. Russia obtains Port Arthur, and it's home to their Pacific fleet. It allows them to have a naval presence in the East, because Russia, as I'm sure many people know, extends from the Baltic all the way to the Pacific. But so in terms of moving land forces, they could always move land forces.
And millions of Russians settled in the Far East, in eastern part of what's now Russia, into Siberia.
Exactly. And a lot of the indigenous people who lived there, almost all of them Russified. But what's really interesting is that you could move your troops across land, but you couldn't obviously move your ships across land. So you needed a year-round port. Now, Vladivostok is too far to the north. So that
would be their other Pacific port, but it's too cold.
Exactly. So they wanted a warm water one that they could use year-round. Port Arthur was perfect. Now, the Japanese ambushed them in Port Arthur, destroyed the fleet, shelled Port Arthur, and then launched a land invasion. The Russians sailed around their magnificent Baltic fleet, which at one point in time had been the most advanced fleet in the West. But due to lack of innovation, due to, like I say again, nepotism within the military, you were getting people who were promoted not because they were the best and brightest, but because they were relatives of the Tsar, you know, led this antique fleet of ironclads. You know, you think Civil War ironclads, the Monitor and the Merrimack, sailed around from the Baltic. It took them maybe 9 months or so. They were half starved when they arrived in the Pacific, and they were demolished in their first engagement at the Battle of Tsushima, which coincidentally, which I say significantly, Admiral Yamamoto took part in that. That was his first big naval engagement, was the Battle of Tsushima.
And he was later to become an important player in World War II.
Exactly. Well, he was to lead the attack on Pearl Harbor. This was the most humiliating defeat for the Russians because they were defeated by an Eastern power, and not only an Eastern power, but they were also defeated by a smaller power, although it is worth noting that the West took no notice of this because the Slavs are not viewed as part of East or West. I say West because that's how the Asians view them as part of the West. The West views them as part of the East, but really they're neither. When the Russians were defeated by the Japanese, this should have been a wake-up call to the West. People in the West should have been going, oh my God, you know, the Japanese destroyed a modern military power. We really should take heed. No, they said, it's just the Russians.
So it's significant on a couple of grounds. One is that Russia's attempts to be a Pacific power, and the second is the emergence of Japan as a modern military power.
Well, and the third was the long-term effects. You saw the first Red Revolution in Russia take place in 1905. Right after the defeat of the Russian
Navy. So what was the connection?
The connection was the massive military defeat, the massive loss of life. The Russians have a history of military service. So unlike, again, like I say, unlike in the United States, where maybe one person on your block was in the military, in Russia, everybody was in the military. It was, you know, it's a very militarized society. So when thousands of Russians died at Port Arthur, died at Tsushima, died fighting in Manchuria, these were sons and daughters of Russia. It infuriated the Russian people. That and poverty soon followed because Russia went bankrupt again fighting in Manchuria and in the Far East because now they'd lost both their fleets and now to rebuild them. And so what you see now is you see poverty followed by the massive loss of life.
And so then there's a revolution in 1905 in Russia.
Exactly. And that's the famous movie. If any of our listeners get the chance to see, it's called Potemkin. Absolutely phenomenal silent movie. But it's about this revolution, and it took place on board naval vessels. Now, it also did set a unique precedence in Russian history. The revolution began on board the Navy ships. Now, traditionally in the West, we think of military coups, we think of the army. Well, in Russia, for some reason, all of the intellectuals went into the Navy. So this revolution was born out of the Navy. It failed, but we would later see the Bolshevik Revolution also succeed because of the Navy.
And certain reforms came about as a result of the 1905 revolution against the Tsar. I mean, he wasn't overthrown in 1905, but political parties became legalized. They've had, for the first time, an elected legislature, the Duma. And so things were put in motion which allowed for the emergence of, say, socialist parties, for example. And they got a little chance to get out there, although I'm sure the Tsar didn't dismantle the secret police. He continued, I'm sure, to monitor.
Not at all. He really continued to crack down. I mean, Lenin, as many people know, was imprisoned and later exiled. Stalin was imprisoned. The Bolshevik revolutionaries were largely forced to go underground, but that was because what they were advocating for was the removal of the Tsar. And obviously, the Tsar wasn't ready to give up power.
Sure. It would be as if you were organizing the United States, say, to replace our president with some kind of a new leader who would be picked by some other group.
And if you imagine that our president was president for life, too. Yes. It would be as if President Obama were to declare himself president for life. And, you know, like Robert Mugabe, you know, Bob's president for life. And but if he were to become, you know, president for life, he's the all dominant force, the executive force in the country. And the people were to suddenly say, or a portion of the population was to suddenly say, no, we should have a government that's dominated by the working class instead. Because you got to remember, the reality of what came out of the Bolshevik Revolution, the principles behind them are two different things. What motivated people to become Bolsheviks was because the principle behind the revolution was, we're going to give power to the working class. You're a worker, you work in a factory, you work on a farm, you should hold the reins of power, considering that you could control the means of production.
Well, then now to go back to the revolution of 1905, the military took sides with whom?
Well, with the Tsar, albeit though the Navy initially took sides with the revolutionaries.
So at this point, the military was still strongly enough in favor of the status quo to keep the Tsar in power, but he did have to concede to the constitutional changes we just mentioned.
Absolutely, and a lot of that was born out of, well, not the constitutional changes, but a lot of the support for the Tsar during this period was born out of the fact that the Russian nobles ruled the army. But also the Bolshevik movement was not very mature yet either. By 1917, with the total death toll of World War I and the massive desertions taking place from the army and the starvation in the streets, the Bolsheviks really matured and gained momentum.
Well, let's talk about World War I, because we've had 1905, you have military disaster, humiliation, the economy on its rocks, a revolution which isn't successful for certain changes. And then just 9 years later, you have the commencement of this disastrous global industrial world war. How does Russia get involved in World War One?
Well, Russia is really one of the first powers to get involved. After the death of Archduke Franz Ferdinand by Serbian extremists.
So he's assassinated in 1914, right?
Yep, in Sarajevo
he's
by
the,
members.
The heir of the Austro-Hungarian throne, right?
The only heir. He's assassinated by a Serbian nationalist, a member of a secret society called the Black Hand. Gabriela Princi was his name. And he murders Franz Ferdinand. Austro-Hungary calls for blood, invades Serbia. Serbia, which is a Slavic, they are a Slavic people and an ally of the Russians. The Russians say we must defend our Slavic brethren, invade Serbia themselves. They declare war on Austro-Hungary. Well, France and Britain, who are allies of Russia, declare war on Austro-Hungary. Germany, which is an ally of Austro-Hungary, declares war on France and Britain and
so
Russia.
So it was a domino effect. The Russians, the British, the French are allies. I think a lot of people think World War I began when Germany invaded Belgium and France. But in fact, it really has to do with the Russians coming to the rescue of the Serbians.
Absolutely. And when we look at today, you know, history doesn't change. It evolves, but it doesn't change. I mean, it evolves in so much as the names change and the locations change, but fundamentally, history repeats itself. You're seeing that today with these military alliances between Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, and Venezuela, and several of the other Latin American countries, we see the same series of alliances building up. But the key for people to remember is that World War One didn't break out because Germany invaded France. It broke out because Austro-Hungary invaded Serbia. Likewise,
and the Russians came to the rescue of their Slavic brothers.
People need to bear in mind that if we, let's say, bomb Iran or we invade Syria, both of which are Russian allies, it can have the same knock-on effect. You don't have to invade Russia to have enough of a knock-on effect for them and China.
What is interesting, though, that essentially the Yugoslavia, which was independent for many years after World War II, non-aligned under Tito, is now under the Western sphere. As a result of our military intervention, our bombing campaigns, the Russians can't be too happy that their Slavic brothers are controlled by the U.S. and NATO now.
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things the Russians would like to see is they would like to see a greater return to a greater Russian empire. The key to remember is that Putin is a combination between, he's a combination between a czar and a Bolshevik. He is Peter the Great and I would have to say he's Peter the Great and Joseph Stalin all in one. And I say that because he is a Bolshevik czar.
He's a Bolshevik czar.
He flies the red flag. The second largest party is the Communist Party. His policies mirror that of the Communist Party. He's, in fact, one of my favorite examples is that he returned the Russian national anthem to that of the Soviet national anthem. Under Yeltsin, it was actually just a lyricless tune. It was just instrumentals. And Russian Olympic athletes famously said, this is the most unpatriotic thing I've ever heard. Well, Putin becomes president. He brings the guy in who wrote the original Soviet national anthem and says, Write me a new one that sounds just like the old one. And the words are very similar. And the tune is the exact same. So Putin wants to... He realized the faults of czarist system. Having a czar himself, well, he's an elitist. It's an elitist system. You need something archaic, for the masses. Yeah. It's archaic. You need something for the masses.
He's not going to become a monarchist. He's not going to bring back Louis XVI in France. They have a monarchist party, but it's not going
to
happen.
No. He realized that communism holds appeal to the masses, and he also realizes the eventual ability to spread Bolshevism throughout places like Western Europe and Eastern Europe.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context War Report on listener-sponsored WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and we're streaming live at WPKN.org. I'm your host, Ken McDermott-Rowe, and I'm speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marchand McDermott-Rowe about Russia as a rival to the United States for global power. In particular, we're examining important military and political events in Russian history, and we're trying to gain a better understanding of the Russian mentality, as well as Russia's global objectives and its military capabilities. And we'll consider what this all means for the United States.
On one side, you have Russia, China versus the U.S. and NATO. Russia, China, and her allies versus the U.S. and NATO. And what we're starting to see is we're starting to push each other around. Particularly the United States is getting much more aggressive against Russia's allies. Well, just like Austro-Hungary invading Serbia, eventually the Russians are going to decide they had enough military.
Yeah, we don't know what that point is going to be, but it may come to pass. Now, exactly. Can we look, how did the Bolshevism, the coming to power of the Bolsheviks, what did it have to do with World War One?
Oh, it had everything to do with World War One. The disasters on the Eastern Front were costing Russia dearly in terms of manpower, in terms of money. The country was going bankrupt.
This is the Eastern Front is where the Russians were fighting the Germans.
Yes, exactly. And likewise, the Austro-Hungarians. And so what we're starting to see is the beginning of starvation, high unemployment, lots of death, lots of debt. And so
What was the condition of the Russian army in World War One? Were they formidable? Were they well trained? Were they
at the beginning of the
equal to the Germans and the Austro-Hungarians?
At the beginning of the war, they were very well. They were probably the best they'd been since the Russo-Japanese War. The biggest problem was that in 1914 they got slaughtered, like most Western armies who didn't dig trenches right away. They got slaughtered.
You start maneuvering with your Cossacks and horses against machine guns, you're gonna get slaughtered.
So they found that, you know, re-equipping these men, they were throwing men into battle with every other man has a rifle, which people iconically associate with Enemy at the Gates, but
which is a World War II movie about two rival snipers in
Stalingrad,
right?
Yep. And I think one thing that you see when you look at World War One was something very similar. And so, and then of course the officers staying behind and letting their men go over the top. So one of the things you start to see is a lot of discontent within the military. And what's interesting is the revolution began not with the Bolsheviks necessarily. It began with the shootings outside the Winter Palace, the protesters being shot. And then the Tsar went to the front to take command of the army personally. And the army just stopped the train and said, "You are going to resign. We've had enough."
Just like that. So the army turned on the Tsar during the war as a result of it.
In 1917.
At that point, 3 years of mayhem. The economy, I'm sure, was in pretty bad shape. And the army was a pivotal factor.
Yes. And that's, in fact, actually when you had moderates take over the government.
The Kerensky.
Kerensky, thank you. The Kerensky government. Now, the Kerensky government
Were two revolutions in 1917. The one...
That's what I'm about to get to. You had the Kerensky government, who were the ones who stopped the train. And they said, look, you know, they said to the Tsar, you're going to resign, you're going to have no power, and we're going to have a democratic pluralistic society. Well, wonderful. But Kerensky wanted to continue the war. So Lenin the Bolshevik said, no, this is a no-go. We're not going to continue the war. The whole reason why we had a revolution was to end the war. The whole reason why we agreed to support the Kerensky government was to end the war. Well, when they didn't end the war, the Bolsheviks revolt against the Kerensky government, and that's when you had the iconic October Revolution. It was against the Kerensky government and its white Russian supporters, the white Russians being the czarists, the reds being the communists.
At that point, they thought they might evolve into a constitutional monarchy.
No,
the czar was gone already.
He was gone already. The hope, I think, in the eyes of czarists was that he would be a constitutional monarch, but in the eyes of people like Kerensky was that they would have a multi-democratic system.
One thing we talk about in the war report is the importance of your national security troops, say, the Gestapo or the SS.
Or the NKVD in
Russia. NKVD in Russia. Or in the United States, what do we have? We have your
Homeland Security.
Versus your regular army types. The Tsar did not have and I think the idea is that your national security types, whether the Gestapo or Homeland Security or whatever, are going to be very, very loyal to the government, come what may. Whereas your rank and file soldier, maybe he's a conscripted person, his loyalty is much more soft. In Russia in 1917, the Tsar didn't have a strong enough national security force to put down the army?
No, he had his Cossacks, but fundamentally the army turned on him. He relied, like most Western powers at the time, or in fact most world powers at the time, he had his secret police, but he relied very heavily on the army. You know, the army made up his imperial guard. You know, he didn't have a political wing. Now what you see emerge out of the Bolshevik Revolution is the Cheka. It goes Cheka, NKVD, KGB. Well, along with a couple other organizations like the MBG, the UDG, and the MVKGB. So you go through a lot of...
So the Tsar had its political police, but the Bolsheviks, when they got power, took it to another level?
Well, the Tsar had his... They were like political police, but it was different with the Bolsheviks. You had the Cheka during the Civil War, who were particularly brutal. Their job was to root out white Russians and help squash the counter-revolution during the Russian Civil War. After that, you saw the men like Dzerzhinsky, who was the head of the Cheka, decided he had no more stomach for bloodshed. He said, look, the Civil War's over. Let's go back to a peacetime policing role as opposed to a political police. Well, Stalin comes to power. Dzerzhinsky dies of a coronary. People conveniently die around Stalin, I would like to point out. It's kind of amusing because a lot of people seem to have heart attacks around him, and I don't think it's purely from stress. But
you wonder how guys like that could ever get people to work for him. But that's
well, you know, I mean, if you're just like, you know,
it's like in the movies where the bad guy shoots everybody who works for him, and you keep saying, why does anybody work for this
guy?
Well,
if they're all having coronaries, you know, I mean, you just assume they should drop the high fructose corn syrup or something, you know. You don't know they're all getting off. Actually, it's an interesting that you should say that. But in Russia, it was because there was nowhere you could be safe.
Well, but now, okay, now Lenin gets into power in the late 1917, the October Revolution. Bolsheviks are in power. What does he do about the war and the army?
Well, Lenin had a different approach. He had Trotsky, who was really the head of the Red Army, and he trusted the Red Army. He had the Cheka, but after the Civil War, the Cheka started to take a backseat role. It was when
But
Lenin
in 1917, died. In 1917, does he immediately end the war?
Yeah. He surrenders. As soon as the Bolsheviks take over, he signs a peace treaty with Germany and surrenders most of Eastern Europe and brings Russia back to its really 17th century borders.
So this is the equivalent almost of the loss of territory that occurred with the collapse of the modern Soviet Union?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's completely analogous. And that's something that made Stalin in particular very bitter.
Did this result when Lenin gave up, you know, surrendered or made a peace treaty and gave up all this land, did that cause a lot of discontent in Russia? We're losing our empire? Or were people so miserable at that point that wasn't a big issue?
I think people were so miserable at that point. It did make some people bitter. None more than Stalin, I should say. But I think the vast majority of Russians were just so overwhelmed by the sense that, well, we have the government in our hands. You know, we're the victors. The people own everything. I mean, you know, I think to a great extent, people were delirious with the fact that they couldn't believe they did it. So I think they were willing to accept the sacrifice because they so desperately wanted the war over, and they so desperately wanted to be independent of the Tsar. So really for them, I think just having the revolution in and of itself was enough.
So they were willing to go along with the peace. I mean, they were sick of the war. So I suppose giving up the Western lands was a price they felt they had to pay. Now, Lenin, as luck turns out, he gets shot almost as soon as the war is over, right? And he doesn't last that much longer. What happens to him in 1918? There's an assassination attempt?
There are actually a couple, but the most notable is in 1918 when he's shot through the jaw and the neck, and it takes him a while to recover. Lenin then, now, this is my personal opinion, but this is as a historian and somebody who spent a lot of time studying Stalin. I think it was orchestrated by Stalin, because Stalin was very, very bitter about the surrendering of the Russian Empire. He was jealous of the fact that Lenin was giving the most prestigious positions to Trotsky, Kamenev, Zinoviev, and Bukharin. And so, and meanwhile making Stalin secretary general of the party, which really was a bureaucratic position. It was a, you know, we have an empty seat that needs to be filled. That put Stalin there. And so Stalin was very bitter.
Lenin takes a long time to recover, and then he has a series of strokes in the early 20s. He doesn't make it to, I think he dies in 1924. He's only like about 53 years old.
That's another thing that's really weird, if you ask me. Lenin, most people have a couple strokes, maybe. Most people who have strokes might have one or two, and they might be spread out. Lenin has, I believe it was three or four strokes, one right after the other, right after the other.
He's 51, 52 years old.
51, 52, in decent health. He was a fit man. I mean, you look at photographs of him, this was not, you know, a roly-poly out of shape guy. I mean, yeah. You know, it doesn't seem to make sense. I mean, if he had one stroke, okay. If he had two, all right, fair enough. But four, it was just so absurd. He eventually has so many strokes, he becomes virtually paralyzed. And goes partially mad. His last will and testament, though, was to ask that Stalin be removed, because Stalin was, in his words, too brutal. And so Lenin didn't like where it was going. Trotsky didn't like where it was going. But Stalin somehow managed to win over some of the most influential members of the Politburo, most notably Kamenev, Zinoviev, and Bukharin, all three of which would later on have appointments in the basement of the Lubyanka NKVD headquarters to be executed.
Talk about the difference between Lenin and Stalin.
They were two polar opposites. Lenin could be very brutal. Lenin did instigate a Red Terror after the assassination attempt on him. But after the Civil War was over, Lenin was a different person. He was much more of a intellectual. He came from a well-educated family. His father was a professor at St. Petersburg University. So he came from a good background. Stalin, on the other hand, came from a peasant background. You know, his parents could neither read nor write. His father used to beat him incessantly. You know, they were really two completely different people. And Lenin was much more ideologically focused. He was much more...
He was a true Marxist.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I have no doubt that Lenin would have, in many ways, had he not died, become a sort of czar like Putin is. But I think, like Putin, he would have had the principle of trying to bring back some prosperity to Russian people. And Lenin was not afraid to cooperate either, which I think is a very important thing to note about him. He worked well with others. He worked with Trotsky. And Trotsky was, again, more of an intellectual. You know, Kamenev, Zinoviev, Bukharin, these men all balanced each other out. Now in comes Stalin. And Stalin's not only doesn't take no for an answer, but also he's paranoid. He sees threats everywhere. He sees counter-revolutionaries everywhere. So he just shoots anyone and everyone. I mean, during his reign, he went through Dzerzhinsky, Yagoda, Yezhov, the Bloody Dwarf, as Yezhov was known, and then finally Beria. So he went through four heads of the NKVD. And it was all because, well, you know, Dzerzhinsky has a coronary, you know, Yagoda's losing his zeal, bang. Yezhov's losing his zeal, bang. And the only reason Beria didn't get shot until after Stalin's death was because Beria was probably the only person who was more despotic than Stalin was.
You've been listening to In Context War Report. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I've been speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott Rowe in part one of a two-part series on Russia's history and its reemergence as a formidable rival to the United States for global power today. In the next edition of the War Report, we will continue our discussion by examining more recent events in Russian history, from Joseph Stalin to Vladimir Putin. And we will conclude with an analysis of Russia's current geopolitical objectives and military capabilities, and their implications for the national security of the United States. In Context War Report is produced by MDR Productions, Inc., and is broadcast on non-commercial, listener-sponsored WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and streams at WPKN.org. Check out In Context on Facebook and watch our videos on the In Context Report YouTube channel. In Context programs are archived for free listening at incontextreport.com and WPKN.org. Thanks for joining us on In Context War Report. See you next time.